Welcome to the What Dreamers Do podcast. I'm your host, Carla Gover, an Appalachian musician, flatfoot dancer, mama, creative, and dreamer from Kentucky. I'm on a mission to inspire others to realize their dreams and live their most creative lives. Grab you a mason jar full of sweet tea or something a little stronger and pull up a chair, because it's time to get your dream on. Who's been following you? Because that's what dreamers do. All right. Welcome, dreamers. I'm really happy to be here today doing an interview. It's kind of strange time for me because I'm sleep deprived. I've just flown across the Atlantic and I have had very little sleep, and I am sitting in a van with ballad singer and clogger Jennifer Reed from Northern Manchester, and we're going to learn a lot more about all of the cool and interesting musical and dance related and ballad related projects that she does. So thanks so much for being here with us and letting me hang out in your van today and interview you.
Yeah, that's cool. Thank you for coming all the way across the Atlantic.
Well, I'm excited to be here. We are in Cambridge, by the way, home of a somewhat famous school. Mm-hmm. And it's really lovely, and it's interesting to be in this little home on wheels. So maybe that would be a good place to start, is just talking about, you know, how you came to live in this van and how that serves your creative life.
Mm-hmm. So I used to live in a place called Todmorden, which is now kind of up and coming. There's a lot of cool, good-looking graphic designer types moving there, which may or may not have had something to do with why I had to get out. But we love Todmorden for all it is. And I did some acting. Shane Meadows did a period drama, which is now critically acclaimed, I'm supposed to say all the time. It's based in the 1700s around the Cragvale Coiners, which were a gang of, which was mainly a family, and then they had like other outlying members of the gang who used to clip coins, and they eventually almost flooded the economy of England, and the taxman came and kind of got them and hung all the main cool ones. So that's what the drama is about. It's called The Gallows Pole, and I was cast as the landlady, very luckily, and I made the landlady sing because it was all improvised. So I sing like 1700 songs. I musically directed the wake scene in the first episode. It's called The Gallows Pole, the drama. So, yeah, you know, that furnished me with a little bit of cash.
Okay.
To then up sticks to Sheffield and buy a van to live in. And then from then, I've just kind of been quite mobile. So if I get work, say, in Preston, I can stop over in Preston for the night and then take a jaunt down to Cambridge, for example, to meet cool people, and then like drive back in the evening. Or it just means I've got a bit more flexibility, and it also means that I probably have to do more festivals now, which I am still coming to terms with the idea.
You're obliged to now.
Yeah,
but I love the fact that even though I know there are probably times when it's not easy to make a decision that bucks so many social norms, it seems like a really bold move in service of following your creative muse. Mm-hmm. And that takes a lot of courage, so hats off.
Thank you
about that. And it kind of speaks to something we were chatting about earlier in terms of how one thing that you and I have in common, and by the way, folks, we met over the internet, you know, mutual friends introduced us, like, you guys need to know each other. And one of the things that we have in common as an interest is folk ballads, music of the people, music that's used as a tool for social change and social justice. Mm-hmm. And the ways that we can uncover our history, cultural history, through studying the music. And so one thing that I thought you had some interesting thoughts about was the way that we now have a tendency to leave the singing to the ultra, ultra professionals, when really singing and dancing and all of these folk traditions are meant for all of us to do them. Mm-hmm. So do you do workshops? How do you approach that, or how do you address that in your performances and your teaching?
So the people that I work with almost always have a diminished sense of identity, whether that be just from living in the world that we're living in right now or growing up in it. Everyone can find another aspect of their identity when I bring this material to them, the material in question. So, the material that I'm talking about is 19th century broadside ballads, usually, because they're quite visual, as opposed to the songs in dialect, which are of the oral tradition, which are kind of mentally visual, but I need to kind of draw them in first. So this whole kind of print tradition is very handy because they've got woodcuts, the texts are kind of interesting when I speak about printing. My friend who's a printer has furnished me with quite a few printing facts and a few printing phrases, so that kind of makes it sound like I know what I'm talking about. And then when people use the songs that I put in front of them, so I usually try and prescribe them stuff. So if there's a woman from Oldham, I'll say, okay, I've got three songs about Oldham, what type of thing are you interested in? And she'll say social justice or like protests, like around about the 1800s. So I'll be like, cool, I've got this perfect song for you. Or if they're just interested in daft stuff, I'll be like, here's one, an Oldham chap visits the Queen, and they get on like a house on fire. Everything with fun and glee and laughter all at Oudham and actually folk were all like me has happened to come from Oudham. Apparently that's what the Queen said, and I doubt it. So people find themselves in these songs and then they start to get really interested, and then when they realise that they're allowed to sing them, that's when this stuff really takes shape, and it's just exciting.
Well, just because I think some of my listeners might not know, can you give a brief description of what is a broadside ballad?
Mm-hmm. A broadside ballad is, do you have blue roll in the United States?
That doesn't ring a bell.
It's like kitchen roll for bars, but it's a blue colour.
I think I've seen that.
Do you have in toilets, do you have like the blue long paper that you can like pull out of the
I think they have that more
dispenser?
At service stations.
Yeah, it's very lowbrow. Mm-hmm. So that kind of texture, bad toilet paper texture, almost see-through and very rough, is pretty much what broadside ballad paper was like. That's what they felt like. So they were, by their very design and by their nature, were not meant to last. So the fact that we have so many in collections in England and in America and loads of other places is quite amazing. But then, of course, we are always at the mercy of collectors for what they chose to preserve in their collections. Mm-hmm. So in Oldham, for example, in the local studies library, there's loads of Orangemen ballads, which obviously isn't very, you know, up everyone's street, especially with you going to Ireland. I'm sure they'd have something to say about that. So again, if you're not really interested in that and we're looking for a history of Oldham, but then you've been kind of sidelined into this collector eye view, that's when you've got to be careful. So anyway, broadside ballads are usually around about A4 size, maybe even double that. They have a title at the top. Sometimes it says as sung by someone, which is quite rare, or the printer's name. Sometimes the printer's name has been scratched out so that the hawker can sell it in other counties without being detected. Mm. If it didn't sell so well in Manchester, just scratch the printer's name out. When you get to Nottingham, just say it was printed this morning and see if it sells any quicker. So I appreciate the Del Boy nature of ballads. It's very hit or miss. And then they've usually got around 12 to 18 verses. The Old English ones from the 1600s are a bit longer. And I did once try to sing those hungover in the Bodleian Library and didn't get invited back. Would you believe it? But I can give you an example of a ballad if you would like.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, sing you just a little short one. Why have I offered? That's a good one. Maybe I'll do Victoria Bridge on a Saturday night. That's quite a good example of a ballad. So, whoever may travel or Manchester gravel will see many things to astonish his sight, but sure he must notice wherever his court is Victoria Bridge on a Saturday night. Such running and rushing, such jostling and pushing, it looked as though Babel had settled through spite, or old Nick to God, one or two kids aboard on Victoria Bridge on a Saturday night. If you trouble with physic, there are doctors with physic, there are lozenges, boluses, poppies and pills, with ointment for drawing and baccy for choring, will blister your chops, see you red in the gills. There's snuff for your noses and sal for your toeses, and poultry and pigs, pickle pork and police, with porkers and fenders and newspaper vendors and Stretford black puddings a penny apiece. That's kind of how they go.
It reminds me of Gilbert and Sullivan.
Totally. Like, you can see where the music hall comes in.
That's right.
And then it builds up into, like, celebrity, and then you totally lose folk art and traditions, and that's why we're put on earth to rectify that.
Yeah, so this was a tradition that was born as a folk movement. It was something that the people participated in, and it was something that everybody could be a part of, and you didn't have to be on American Idol or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely.
To sing them.
Absolutely. Like the songs written by, I mean, a lot of the Lancashire dialect poems were turned into songs because a lot of them were written just as poetry. But there's a fair few songs out of them as well. So, for example, I mean, I'm searching for it in my book, but it's just a crutch. I know it off by heart. So The Weaver of Wellbrook, which is from North Manchester, Failsworth area, that's all about being a weaver, and it mentions like work dialect in it, and this is kind of more in the oral tradition because this would have been passed down in that way, and it has the rhythm of the hand loom when you sing it, so that's kind of handy as well to keep you in on time, but also kind of adds to the, you know, the feeling you're getting, because when it's the oral tradition, it's all bodily and feeling based. When it's the print tradition in the city, you're overhearing it, you're on your way to work, you're busy with other stuff, you know, it's the start of like industrialization, it hits a bit differently than if you heard this, you know, down the pub on a Tuesday evening after handloom weaving all day, after seeing your wife for quite a bit and chatting and sorting everything out, and your kids came in, then you went to the pub. It's just a different, more homely feeling. But the homely feeling was what was trying to be sold to people through the broadside ballads when they went to the cities to live in the slums with industrialisation.
Well, the Stanley Brothers advertise for Martha White Flour, so I'm going to do a sort of cooking advertisement here to support this podcast. I have a confession to make. I love to cook from scratch, but many nights these days I'm only cooking for my son and myself. When I'm busy and tired, sometimes it's a little bit too easy to get takeout. So I decided to try some of those meal kit boxes that I saw advertised, and I went through four different ones until I found the one that I like best, Home Chef. Every week, I get to pick four meals that I think my family would like, and they send the ingredients right to my door. This isn't processed food either. It's just healthy meats, fresh vegetables, and grains that I prepare. It usually takes me 30 minutes or less to get supper on the table, and my picky son loves every meal. Plus, it's way cheaper than takeout. If you want to try it out, just go to carlagover.com/supper. I don't get paid for this endorsement. I just truly like the product. And if you sign up using my link, they will send me credits toward my own boxes. And with an almost 13-year-old boy in the house, I could use them. Plus, all that good food is going to help me keep recording this podcast for you. Just do me a favor and don't tell Granny. Yeah, so it began to get a little bit more cerebral with the broadside ballads versus just like the really visceral experience of the oral tradition. Mm-hmm. Well, I like that you know, talking about the weaving, because I know that's something else that you focused on. You are a weaver. Do I understand that correctly?
I can weave. I do. I weave on it more like a handheld loom. So they're more like an A5 size little loom. Mm-hmm. And I love to do workshops with people because you never know what's going to come out. Some people just do straight lines and immediately I tell them like, it's not made of glass. You can move it up and down and stuff. And then other people just get straight in there and put like pipe cleaners hanging off the end of it and like sweets wrappers, and it looks really cool. So it's interesting to see what abstract things people are willing to share on the loom.
So do you do workshops that are a mix of music and weaving, or?
They usually always work out that way because I can't help, but if we're weaving and then we're talking about weaving, and then I'll kind of like sing a weaving song to just kind of, on the lower end, let people cosplay being a weaver. On the higher end, invite people into the beautiful, visceral, amazing experience of being a weaver and singing weaving songs and all that comes with it.
So we know that you know, have this appreciation for, you know, bringing the music to the people and illuminating the history and sort of the power to the people aspect of this kind of music. Mm-hmm. What are some of your other artistic goals, you know, that you have for yourself in whatever realm, whether it be more acting or more singing or more teaching? Mm-hmm. What kinds of things are you working on?
So my hero is Fred Dibner. You ever heard of Fred Dibner?
I don't think so.
Oh, so he was a steeplejack from Bolton, which means that he pulled down chimneys and like climbed up really high on tops of buildings and stuff. And he ended up being, he was just like a self, I don't know how self-taught he was, but a lot of the Lancashire dialect authors were self-taught, which is why I always banned that phrase about, because I fancy myself as self-taught as well. Because it's more, I am total antiquarian, like I'm a hobbyist in this, but I've become an expert just through being obsessed with it. But Fred Dibner was essentially a steeplejack, and then he got his own TV show because people found him friendly. And then he ended up speaking about the Industrial Revolution through, like, steam engines. I think he sunk a mine shaft in his garden. Like, he was no joke. He was a great guy, really funny guy. Big hero in Bolton, really. He's died now. But I kind of want to be that person that you can't say that I don't know what I'm talking about, and I feel respected for all the time and effort that I've put in, and I just feel good about ballads. You know, I feel like I've dedicated my life to the right cause. I'm getting pretty well known with it, and it feels cool. Like, that's what I really appreciate that. Because after I did the drama, Trad Folk, which is one of, like, the big magazines, I've never really courted them, but then again, why would I? Mm-hmm. And one of the guys, a guy called John Wilkes, wrote about my performance in the Gallows Pole and wrote about all the songs that I chose and, like, the time period of it, and it was just so validating. I called him up personally to thank him. I just went, thank you so much, because you always feel like you're, like, imposter syndrome is rife, but it was really, really cool to, like, pack those anxieties into a little bag and go, only took 13 years to get rid of those. It was nice.
It is. Recognition, yeah, or validation for what you're doing. And peer recognition is another one I think that's especially sweet.
Yeah, yeah, it's amazing. So I try and work in that respect. So I try and share what I can in terms of, like, workshops, singing, weaving, painting, clogging, banner making, all of the above, with children through to people with dementia. I love to do singing with people with dementia. It's cool. My dad's got dementia, so I'm trying to surround myself with it as opposed to totally run away from it. It's important that I must face this head on to be the best that I can be for my dad. And then, yeah, clogging. I'd like to come to America. That is a big one for me. I want to meet ballad singers in America. I want to meet cloggers. I want to meet flat footers. I want to meet everyone in America. Can you make that happen?
I can certainly help you. Which, that we should speak a little bit about that. Yeah. We haven't talked about your dancing. So I'd be interested to hear what got you into the Lancashire clogging traditions and even the singing, like if it's something from your family or your community or how it all came about.
Yeah, it's nothing to do with family or community at all.
Okay.
I just had an Oldham Tinkers CD when I was younger, and I just got obsessed with it because it was just really, really funny and silly songs. Mm-hmm. And I thought, these are fantastic. And then I went away to Barcelona, I came back, and then I volunteered at Chetham's Library in Manchester, which people know as, like, the Harry Potter Library, because it looks like Harry Potter. But I think it's the first, it's either the first library in the English-speaking world or the first English-speaking library in the world, I can't remember which. I think it was set up in, like, the 1400s, so that's why it's got the Harry Potter vibe. Mm. But it's a fantastic place, and Michael, who was the librarian at the time, he had a penchant for 19th century print culture, so as a result, he kind of indoctrinated me into ways. So I just started digitising some ballads, and then after that, I kind of got obsessed with them because I started to see place names come up and, you know, funny little bits of dialect, and I thought, oh my God, how have these been, like, trapped in this box for so long, and why is no one using them, you know? And, yeah, my dancing. So I learned from the Lancashire Wallopers. I learned from Harry Cowgill in Fleetwood, a school in Fleetwood, I think, where they hired it out for the Wallopers weekend many, many years ago. And I just thought I needed another string to my bow. Like, I can sing. I could tap dance back in the day when I was younger. Mm-hmm. So let's switch it into clogging, and then I can give people the full experience because I know that I can deliver quality. So let's do it. So then it cost like 50 quid to go to this session. Mm-hmm. And it was over 2 days, and because I'm so tight, I practiced every single day for a year after that I learned it, and then now it's ingrained in my head and will never go away. So I got my money's worth, is what I'm trying to say there. But I learned Sam Sherry's intermediate waltz, the main 8 steps. I think there's 12 or 13 in total, I might be wrong on that, but I learned the main 8, or the ones that I consider the main 8. It's just so contentious clogging, I don't know what to say, I don't want to get it wrong. So yeah, his steps, he came to be like the head of, like, Lancashire clog in people's minds, but he wasn't necessarily from Lancashire, and he kind of grew up in the music hall tradition, but his name has become synonymous with that Lancashire sound.
So just a little bit of a clogging nerd out question here. Mm-hmm. Do you only do waltz clog, or do you do some 4/4?
I only do waltz clog, but that is a cry for help, saying, please teach me other ways. Because I learnt that clog dance so that when I went to Venice, I sang at the Venice Biennale in 2015 and the opening week in the Giardini, and I clog danced and sang, and I thought, this is really going to, you know, it's such a rich, luxurious environment, and I wanted to bring everyone back down, and I made few people cry, which I felt really good about.
Yeah, that's funny. That's what... That's like a songwriter or a singer, an artist. That's your mark of success. I made him cry. Yeah, yeah, yay. Yeah. Which just sounds kind of crazy to say, but I feel that way too.
Yeah.
Well, another thing that we were talking about, which I think is interesting, and maybe it speaks to like gatekeepers of traditional culture and gatekeepers of those who think that traditional and folk music should be performed with a particular look, in a particular way, but I know that you don't play to those stereotypes of what a ballad singer is, quote-unquote, supposed to look like. Folks, she's got some ink, you know, she just, she has a couple piercings, very cool, hip-looking. No corsets, right?
No, I don't want to sing in a corset, please, dear God. Don't make me do period dress. God, I just think, I kind of play on it now where I'm like, okay, I've come to you in full period dress. You know, I'm wearing the same clothes I've been wearing for 5 days, and it's just a charity shop pair of shorts, an overpriced Tommy Hilfiger shirt, and a little top that I found in a bag on the street. You know, it's nothing. Maybe that is, I mean, that's quite ballad singer of me, though, I suppose, minus the Tommy Hilfiger aspect. But yeah, I just try and be my authentic self, which is now a cringy Instagrammable phrase. But I'm just trying to be like, my passion is I can't, it's undeniable. I can't help but let it shine through. So if you don't leave my performance thinking that you've been harassed by a ballad singer, then I've lost it. But until now, I don't think I have.
Well, I think it's just, you know, obviously it's something that we deal with as Appalachian musicians too. You know, a lot of times there's a certain look that people think that we're supposed to have, or a certain kind of outfit that, you know, you're supposed to wear. Mm. And maybe it's just that performers throughout history have always had to ask themselves some interesting questions about, where do I draw the line between honoring the traditions that I learned and doing something that I can make a living at on stage? And like, sometimes people even take it into the realm of self-caricature in order to make a living, because sometimes that's what sells, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's always just like this interesting dance of, you know, authenticity versus being yourself. And what does it all mean? But you mentioned something about some of the historical people who performed these broadside ballads. What did you call them? You had a name for them.
Hawkers.
The Hawkers.
Hawkers, yeah. So there's the Long Song Seller, which is in Mayhews, London. And he's got all the street hawkers in the book. And the Long Song Seller is the ballad guy. And he's got like a top hat on. But you know, when you see on cartoons where it's like a top hat, but it's as if you've undone like a can of beans and that it's flapping off at the top. It's
yeah.
Like that kind of thing. And you know, he looks down on his look. He looks grumpy in the picture. And he's got like a big stick with a big toilet roll of ballads on. And like, he pulls them down and it says $2.50 for a fardy. And yeah, the hawkers themselves were very down at heel, you know, probably on the last legs. But the way that they were selling this to you meant that you came back to them. So they had a certain charm, which might not necessarily be their singing voice, but, you know, their themes that they were covering, or where they stood, or the tune they put to it, or, you know, the three tunes they just sang in succession over the past 3 weeks. Like, it could be literally anything that really elevates their selling capacity. Because again, ballads were made to be sold. You know, the oral tradition songs, they were made to be passed down and enrich life. And the ballads were, you know, overheard. Like, there's so many Irish ballads in the Manchester collections because of Angel Meadow, the slum. Mm-hmm. And so the printers were trying to sell Irish ballads to Irish workers to remind them of home, you know, to kind of put like play on their heartstrings kind of thing. So again, like, the ballads are business, so they're a bit more devoid, but that's what makes the sellers so interesting, because there's all these different contextual things going on, but then they're still stood on a street corner, probably with one leg leaning on a bit of a crutch, singing out, I hope, a rude song.
It's really interesting. I feel like there's a whole entire other podcast we could have comparing some of these commercialization traditions, you know, dance hall, vaudeville, minstrelsy, mm-hmm. you know, some of the darker and more unsavory parts of the history of, you know, what came out of folk traditions mm-hmm. In large measure, but have evolved into so many other things. But like you, I also, just to bring it back home, really appreciate taking a peek at the roots, going back to the roots, to what is sometimes extrapolation about the early history of the styles. Because, for instance, in Appalachia, where I'm from, I didn't even realize until I was in my teens that, oh, part of this music is coming from the African-American tradition, because nobody ever talked about it. I mean, yeah. It's the banjo, for crying out loud. The whole instrument came from Africa, mm-hmm. and part of it came from indigenous Native American traditions of music and dance. But it wasn't talked about. And so when we go back now and we have to try to sort of piece it together, almost like musical archaeologists, but I also love to examine these roots. And so, guys, I'm looking at this stack. She's got a box of ballads and these cool prints and old broadsides and these old, you know, old print from old presses and whatnot. So I hope that wherever you are, you'll get a chance to listen to her or see her perform, whether in the UK or in the United States, which there's rumor that you're going to be coming in 2024. But if people want to listen to some of your stuff or learn more about you now, what's a good place?
So my website, which I've just done up, all fancy, shiny, and
right.
new. So it's jenniferballads.com. How hard is that to remember? And then I'm also on Instagram, and that's Jennifer Ballads with two S's. I did have the original Jennifer Ballads account, but then I forgot the password, so I had to add another S. I know, I'm so stupid. I'm a branding nightmare. And that's got all pictures of my workshops. I've recently been lead artist for a plant pot festival, making loads of sculptures out of plant pots. And I've felt flower potty. I felt crazy after it. But finally installed them all on Monday. And then it started raining, and I drove past kind of like with one eye open, hoping that we'd all still be there, and they're all still there. They haven't flown away or anything. So that's cool. So that's Instagram. I'm on Twitter as well as Jennifer Reed. I think my website's probably the best place. It's got all the best links and videos, and I'm on Spotify as well. But my recorded stuff on Spotify, I'm not renouncing all recording as bad. But for me, it's all about the performance. It's all about being there. It's all about assessing the vibe in the room. It's all about overhearing conversations at the bar and then changing my set list like five different times to accommodate everyone, you know? Like, there's a woman in Halifax talking about a canal boat, and that's why I bring, like, I've got my box of ballads. I've got maybe 300 songs in here. That's why I bring everything, because then I can be like, oh my God, yeah, I'll do that song and she'll like it. Or, you know, I'll say, oh my God, I overheard you say this. Look, I've got this song for you. Or, where are you from again? I've got this song from there.
It's musical prescriptions.
Total musical prescription. Yeah. Yeah. You will
musical
feel
medicine.
Better. Yeah. Yeah. You'll feel better after this. But yeah, so I've got recorded stuff on Spotify is what I'm trying to say. But I also don't necessarily value recording as a medium at this current juncture. I much prefer to perform, but you can see videos of me online doing that. There's one of me in Preston Market, which you might get a kick out of.
Nice. Well, since the show is called What Dreamers Do, and it's about creativity and all of us finding our creativity, do you have any kind of advice that you would give just about living a creative life? Because mm-hmm. everybody does it differently.
Keep your head down and keep going. Keep going all the time, even when you feel like you're not doing out. You're doing it all. If you're not doing the outdoor work, you're doing the mental work, you're doing the undoing all that crazy knotted up trauma in your body work. You're doing it all the time, you just don't realize. And creativity, remember, it's fun. I always have to remember that this stuff is fun. It's not work.
It's
not
meant to be fun.
Yeah, it's not work, really, is it? Like, I'm stressing out about, oh my God, on my plant pot installation, is it going to last? Like, for God's sake, it's hardly the stock market, is it? But when you get in a creative hole, look after yourself, do face masks, do things like that, that kind of like bring your self-worth up a tiny little bit. Give yourself a rest for 3 days where you think about absolutely nothing. Watch SpongeBob for 3 days on the trot and clear your brain. And then when little things will start coming back to you and you'll think, right, it's it's just, you've just got to keep stopping and starting, but always remember that you're on with it.
I love it.
Cool.
I love it. Well, thank you so much for the great advice, and also for taking the time to chat with me, and for driving all the way down and meeting me in a parking lot in Cambridge. And hopefully next time we'll get a longer visit and we'll get to make some music. Thank you guys for listening. Be sure to look up Jennifer, and we'll see you soon.
Bye.
This episode of What Dreamers Do is sponsored by the online Appalachian Flatfooting and Clogging Academy, the only course of its kind and the most comprehensive step-by-step program available for dancers learning this style. I teach beginning and intermediate students the steps and skills they need to dance to traditional mountain music so that they can be confident, joyful dancers and improvisers. Unlike others who just teach the same handful of steps or who just teach routines, I give you not only a bountiful library of steps, but a framework for understanding how the steps fit together with the music. Learn more about the Academy and get started for free with my video tutorial, The Three Essential Steps for Appalachian Flatfooting and Clogging. Visit www.carlagover.com today. It's a holy fight.